Well, we're wrapping up our Ecclesiastes series today, and we're in chapter 11. And I want to read the first six verses. Ecclesiastes 11, 1 to 6. Cast your bread upon the waters, for after many days you will find it again. Give portions to seven, yes to eight, for you do not know what disaster may come upon the land. If clouds are full of water, they pour rain upon the earth. Whether a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where it falls, there will it lie. Whoever watches the wind will not plant, whoever looks at the clouds will not reap. As you do not know the path of the wind or how the body is formed in a mother's womb, so you cannot understand the work of God, the maker of all things. Sow your seed in the morning, and at evening let not your hands be idle, for you do not know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both will do equally well. Let's pray. Lord, please give us courage to be real about you and the world and ourselves, so we can live wisely with you and the world and ourselves. Amen. It was before World War I, and with the way people were living, it could have even been hundreds of years before that. My grandfather was a young boy, and his family were pioneers in the central west of New South Wales. He wrote some memoirs before he died, and he wrote in that the conditions we lived in were different those days. There was no electricity. We used kerosene lamps. We used bag sides attached to a tray of water which soaked down the hessian to keep the meat and butter cool. My mother used to bake most of our bread, and meat was available from the station properties if you bought the sheep and killed it yourself. I remember one day there was no meat for Dad's dinner and Mum was sick in bed, so I decided to catch some birds. I did this by propping up a box with a stick, putting some wheat under the box, and getting back to wait for the birds to come under the box before pulling the stick away. The result? Two birds, which I killed, cleaned, and plucked for dinner. Unfortunately, they didn't turn out too good. They were as tough as leather, but we were pleased to eat them. When I read that story in these memoirs of my grandfather, it just made me realize how different his life was from my own. And as I read that story, I found myself getting really stressed for Granddad, thinking, that's terrible that that happened to you. I desperately wanted him to have a refrigerator and a freezer and a microwave oven. And that's because I'm very much a child of the Industrial Revolution, and he was living as if he wasn't. I also desperately wanted him to have a phone and the internet, and I wanted him to be able to just ring up and get a meat lover's pizza, for goodness sake. And that's because I'm a child of the Information Revolution. Now, the Industrial Revolution and the Information Revolution have kind of tricked us into thinking that we have mastery of the world and we have knowledge of the world. But the book of Ecclesiastes actually wants us to own up to the fact that often we don't, and we need to know how to live in the light of that. Now, if you've been following this Ecclesiastes series, you might be thinking, yes, there is a lot in Ecclesiastes about how limited our power and how limited our knowledge is. And that generally means that we should just enjoy ourselves. But such a conclusion wouldn't capture the whole teaching of the book of Ecclesiastes well. Because here in chapter 11, there's an intriguing combination of ideas. There's some material that sounds like it could be moving toward resignation, but then there's also material placed alongside a warning against idleness. And the message overall, I think, is that we should engage with life. A bit like Granddad getting on with his bird hunting. Well, the structure of Ecclesiastes 11, 1 to 6 is kind of interesting. Sometimes when Old Testament writers write, it's like they're making a sandwich. Two slices of bread that match up and then some things in the middle that might match up as well. If you look at verses 1 and 2, I want you to think of them as two slices of bread. They've got verse 1 and verse 6 have got similar features in that they are both instructions about what to do. then verses 3 and 5 are perhaps like two slices of lettuce, and they contain similar observations about the world. And that leaves then verse 4 as something of a centre, like a slice of tomato. And there's a little bit of cleverness going on that verse 4 uses the word clouds, which also appears in verse 3. So lettuce meets tomato. And it also uses the word wind, so that tomato in the middle meets the second slice of lettuce as well. It seems to me that the slices of bread on the outside, that is Ecclesiastes 1 and 2 and then 6, are both commands. They're both telling us things to do, and if you look carefully at them, they both contain the expression, "for you do not know." Now, because those two slices of bread are the commands, I want to end the talk there today, because they'll give us something to go away and do. What the lettuce leaves seem to be, that is verses 3 and 5, they seem to be statements. Statements about rain clouds, about trees falling in forests, about the movement of the wind, about the formation of a baby. All things which take us to the limit of our capacity to understand and control things. And at the very centre of it all, in verse 4, I think there is a warning. So today's sermon is lettuce, then tomato, then bread. The warning, then the statements, then the warning, and then the commands. Now, I bet you you've never had a lettuce-tomato-bread structured sermon before. And I've left out the meat because Grandad said it was too tough. So let's have a look at these statements about life. And remember that the motto of the book of Ecclesiastes, this meaningless Hevel word, can often mean hard to understand. Have a look at verse 3, Ecclesiastes 11:3. If clouds are full of water, they pour rain upon the earth. Well, that's true enough, yes, but how do you know when they are full? And how do you know where they're going to be? And how can you make them rain at the right time? Also in verse 3, whether a tree falls to the south or the north, in the place where it falls, there will it lie? Well, yeah, that's true, but who can predict when the tree is going to fall? And exactly which tree in the forest is going to fall? And can we ever be completely sure whether it's going to fall to the north or to the south until it does fall? Have a look at verse 5. You do not know the path of the wind. Yes, indeed. The wind is invisible, unpredictable. Where will the next gust of wind come from and when? Often we just don't know. And we read on. You do not know how the body is formed in a mother's womb. Well, indeed, maybe we do know a bit about cell replication and specialization these days, but exactly how does each cell know what to do? And can we ever be completely sure whether the baby growing inside a woman will have mum's hair color or dad's dimple? Rain clouds, falling trees, gusts of air, mysterious embryos, they're all pointing us to a God who is bigger than us, a God who isn't easy to work out, and who isn't easy to predict. Now, I think that's a very tough truth for us as children of the Industrial Revolution and as children of the Information Revolution. And so some of us would actually want to stand up and challenge these texts and say, well, these are just ancient, naive texts. We do know how a baby is formed in a womb. We can document the order of 3 billion bases of a human DNA sequence and put all the data on a single CD. We can wave a CD in the air and say, that's how a baby forms, I know. We might laugh at the naivety of the weather forecasting technology of the ancient Near East, and we're able to say, we know more, we know better. But does that really mean that we know all the workings of God, the maker of all things? You know, sometimes I wonder if our lives get very busy because we just can't make peace with the fact that we don't know things. I know as a lecturer it's taken me some years to be able to stand in front of a class and say, yeah, I don't know the answer to that question, without this hot rush of anxiety and the need to run to the library as soon as the lecture's over. But sometimes, I think wisdom literature tells us, sometimes it's okay not to know, not to be completely up to date, not to be across all the facts, because we'll never know everything, no matter how many gigabytes of stuff we can put in our pockets. And of course, it's not just that it's hard to understand and hard to know. It's hard to control things, isn't it? Can you actually make it rain? Do you actually govern any forests and tell the trees when they should fall over? Do you tell the wind when to blow? Have you ever actually built a fetus? Can you tell God what to do? I've sat and watched our one-hour-old daughter die in my wife's arms. And I don't have the power to build a baby. You've felt that too, haven't you? That incredible lack of power. There's something about the wisdom literature that just stops you in your tracks. It's humbling. It's sobering. But then what happens next? Do we just get resigned? Do we just give up? Or do we start to trust God in a new way? And then do we do actually something more than even that? Well, if you're beginning to feel resignation wrapping around you like crippling cords, that's why you need a tomato in this sandwich. Have a look at verse 4. It's a warning to us for those times when we just feel like everything is too hard to know and hard to understand and hard to control, so we just want to give up. Verse 4 is telling us not to be idle. And it's actually a teaching that appears across the book of Ecclesiastes. Let's have a listen to Ecclesiastes 4:5. The fool folds his hands and ruins himself. Or Ecclesiastes 10:18. If a man is lazy, the rafters sag. If his hands are idle, the house leaks. The warning against laziness in 11:4 is a bit more subtle. Whoever watches the wind will not plant. Whoever looks at the clouds will not reap. I think the point is that if we keep looking and looking for all the knowledge and the right moment, we keep procrastinating when in fact we shouldn't do that. Now there can be a real spiritual issue here about not taking responsibility for our own lives. Are you a procrastinator? One of those people who's always looking at the clouds and just waiting for the right moment before you actually start that essay. In his best-selling The Road Less Travelled, M. Scott Peck tells this story. He was working as a psychiatrist at the time in an American military base on an island south of Japan. A young wife of a serviceman cut her wrist lightly with a razor blade and was brought into the emergency room. He writes, I asked her why she had done this to herself. To kill myself, of course. And why do you want to kill yourself? Because I can't stand it on this dumb island. You have to send me back to the United States. I'm going to kill myself if I live here any longer. What is it about living here that is so painful? She began to cry in a whining sort of way. I don't have any friends here and I'm alone all the time. Well, that's too bad. How come you haven't made any friends? Because I have to live in a stupid Okinawan housing area and none of my neighbours can speak English. Well, why don't you drive over to the American housing area or to the wives' club during the day so you can make some friends? Because my husband has to drive the car to work. But couldn't you drive him to work since you're alone and bored all day? Peck asked. No, it's a manual car and I don't know how to drive a manual car, only an automatic. Well, why don't you learn how to drive a manual car? The woman who had tried to commit suicide glared at the psychiatrist and said, Learn to drive on these roads? You must be crazy. Reminds me of... It's slow, isn't it? It's slow. Reminds me of the kind of person Proverbs would call a sluggard. Proverbs 22:13. The sluggard says, There is a lion outside, or I will be murdered in the streets. You know, for a lot of reasons to do with personality and upbringing, we can look outside of ourselves for the right situation before we think it's time to act. But wisdom literature is strong on responsibility. If you're a procrastinator, I challenge you to explore why do you need everything to be just right before you start? What's going on for you? that you lack the confidence to act. And I'd want to say, talk to someone about that. What's driving it for you? Talk to someone about it and raise it with God in prayer. So where are we up to? Well, we're out of control, so that says the letters. We're finite creatures with limited knowledge. Do we give up? No, says the tomato. But what does the bread say? Well, it's time for the bread around the sandwich, the advice about the wise living. And the bread says, generosity and engagement. Have a look at verse 1. Cast your bread upon the waters, for after many days you will find it again. Now, verse 1 has been read in a number of ways. Is the writer suggesting we get involved in shipping and export? Cast your merchandise on the water, perhaps? Is it a feeding ducks in the park piece of wisdom? Other ancient sayings suggest that the writer is probably encouraging acts of charity and generosity. There's an Egyptian saying that goes, do a good deed and throw it on the water. When it dries, you will find it. So rather than cast your bread, the Egyptians say, do a good deed. There's an Arabic proverb, do good, throw your bread on the waters, and one day you will find it again. So a sensible interpretation of this sort of metaphor of throwing bread might be that we're to do good things, and one day some kind of benefit may come back to us. In a novel about a woman working with peasants in Nicaragua, she reflects, wars and elections are both too big and too small to matter in the long run, but the daily work, that goes on and it adds up. It goes into the ground, into crops, into children's bellies and their bright eyes. Good things don't get lost. Maybe that's part of the advice here. Good things don't get lost. So do the good thing, even when you lack full understanding and even when you lack full control. And one of the good things that we're to throw out there into the world is our generosity. The next verse continues this theme of generosity with a statement that's a strange twist on the proverb, don't put all your eggs in the one basket. It says when you're giving things away, try to diversify. Give things away to 7, even to 8. So when you're giving things away, try to find new people and new ways to be generous. And note the reason that you do so. It's because you've got no darn idea about what's going to happen. Give portions to 7, yes to 8, for you do not know what disaster may come upon the land. Now it's interesting that the writer in these verses is using the word bread and portions, because these words are used elsewhere in Ecclesiastes as examples of the gifts of God. So there's a point here. When God is generous to you, share the generosity around with 7 or 8 people, and much of the time there'll be something good in it for you in the process. Now, what interesting advice. Because you've got no idea what disaster is coming, you better give stuff away. Now, is that what your mum and dad taught you? Isn't it? Because you do not know what disaster is coming, you better hang on to your stuff. Isn't that what we normally teach our children? It seems that the people of God have a carefree generosity. That's their wisdom. Makes you wonder what you do if there's a global financial crisis happening, doesn't it? Do you throw around some financial incentives? Do you just give away money? Maybe you do. Generosity. It's a difficult topic to bring up when so many of us feel that we're so busy and we've got nothing left to give. One thing I've picked up in reading about time and busyness and work and leisure is that leisure only happens when we feel like we've got the chance to make a choice. Leisure is not only about time without responsibility, but a sense that we're choosing what we're going to do. Well, you know, if you choose to be a generous person, then what you're actually saying is, in a lot of areas of my life, I am actually free and powerful enough to make choices. I can say, yes, I can see you. Yes, I will visit. Yes, I will listen. And in saying those kinds of generous statements, you're saying, actually, I can make choices about my time. And you know, that will actually make you feel more at leisure, not actually more busy. Generosity takes you beyond yourself. It brings out the best in you. It opens your eyes to the reality of other people's existence. It lets you make connections in the most unexpected places and with the most unexpected people. If you're generous, you subvert greed and fear and insecurity. If you're generous, you live life as though you're not a victim, you're not powerless, but you've got power. If you're generous, well then you're living out an act of faith that God will take care of you. And psychologists tell us that it will benefit your mind and your body. And God will tell us that we're imitating Him. Here are some ways of being generous, even if you don't have a lot of money. And see if you can think of these as sharing the gifts that God has given you. You can be generous by allowing yourself to be fully present. You can be generous by accepting people as they are. You can be generous by giving more of your time and interest and concern than is really necessary. You can be generous by talking about what's positive and stimulating and uplifting. You can be generous by giving the benefit of the doubt, or by not blaming, or by paying attention to the person who seems to be left out, or by praising, encouraging, rejoicing. Ask yourself, what bread and portions would I most like to receive from God? And start giving them away. Now, for some of you, a decision to be generous will mean adding things to your diary, because you tend actually to be mean with your time. And so you need to actually put in those visits to the sick neighbours and that Sunday school teaching that you've been avoiding. For others in this room, though, being generous will mean taking things out of your diary, because you're one of these rescuers who does too much. You need to take things out of your diary so that you can be truly present, generously present in the commitments that you already have. And what about that second slice of bread? What about verse 6? Well, it says, sow your seed in the morning and in the evening let not your hands be idle. The big message is engagement. And notice once again, it's engagement with complete awareness of our lack of control. For you do not know what thing's going to succeed. Now the image of sowing seeds is obviously taken from farming, but I think it's a lovely open-ended image, capturing all the ways that we exercise effort for the sake of the future. And to me it feels remarkably close to the parables of Jesus, who seems to encourage us to be enterprising and to not hide ourselves away. I can remember one Sunday afternoon sitting in a lounge room in Mount Druitt with a minister who was supervising our student placement there. Lisa and I were students at the church, and being students, we were feeling a bit out of control. Oh, we'll only be here a year, maybe two. What's the point of trying to get to know people? Do you think you might have a job that you might offer to us when we finish college? If there could be something more permanent, well, then it would be worth our while giving ourselves to this church. And our supervisor answered in a way that suggested he was a lot more comfortable than I was about being out of control and lacking knowledge. He said, I don't know if I can offer you a job here or not. I don't know what's going to happen in a few years from now. Maybe the church won't even be here in a few years from now if God's decided it's done what it needs to do. We don't need certain plans and all the details to be clear. All that I know is that right now you are part of this church. Right now, you are in a community with real people, with real lives, with real stories to tell, who need truth and love and friendship and care. So are you going to get on and do that, or aren't you? Now, the emphasis in my Ecclesiastes talks has been on for people who are doing too much and who are too busy and I've been trying to give you permission to relax a bit. But there are other people out there who just aren't engaging enough with life. And Ecclesiastes looks you straight in the eye and says, I'm as frightened as you at all we can't control and all we don't know, but still I say, cast your bread. Give away your portions. Sow your seed. Don't be idle. It's time. Is this you? You're so frightened by all that you can't control. You're so longing for the right moment that you don't volunteer at church. You still haven't applied for that job. You've retreated from your wife. You're pretending your father doesn't exist. You're ignoring the needs of your nieces and nephews. And you just hope that someone else can care for your lonely neighbour. Well, it's time. Time to trust God with the results. It's time to get up and take some risks. Cast your bread, give your portions, sow your seeds, and entrust yourself to our wise, generous Creator. Let's pray. Wise, generous, engaged Creator, please make us like you. Amen.